Ah, Sunday again. Good Sunday morning. Happy Easter, everybody. This is Ben Murphy on the best of your VOCM mornings. Hope you're having a wonderful long weekend. Hope the Easter Bunny treated you all well. And there's lots of chocolate floating around this morning, or still lots of chocolate to be found. It is nice and early on this Easter morning. And again, hoping you're having the very best weekend and Easter Sunday. It was a busy news week, and we have lots to bring you over the next hour this morning. From the fishery to tattoos to fiscal responsibility for the Newfoundland and Labrador government. We'll be talking tech. We'll be talking fundraisers. So much to bring you this morning here on the best of your VOCM mornings. So grab yourself a cup of coffee, a cup of tea, piece of toast, a biscuit, you name it. Hey, have yourself some chocolate this morning. It is Easter after all, and join us right here on the best of your VOCM mornings. Good Sunday morning, and welcome to the best of your VOCM mornings. I'm Ben Murphy. Hope you're all having a wonderful Easter weekend and a good start to your Easter Sunday. Well, we're just coming off of Good Friday, so we may as well start with the fishery, fish food, and allied workers leadership and John Efford, who led the way at protests at Confederation Building over the last few weeks. Well, they met with Provincial Fisheries Minister Elvis Lovelace for several hours last Friday morning. As a result of progress made in that meeting towards demands for free enterprise and outside buyers, the protests have been halted. Harvesters have declared victory, and then they headed home. Greg Pretty is president of the FFAW. He joined us on Monday morning for an update.
So what exactly was agreed upon in your meeting with the Provincial Fisheries Minister?
Well, as reported on Friday afternoon, we reached a deal with the province on a number of issues. Most significant, I would think, would be the outside buyer issue. And so people who want to come to Newfoundland and purchase can't do so by application. And that was pretty significant. I called for that last year, and people have been calling for that for years, in essence. And so it's finally here. The other issue, of course, was the caps, the processing caps on plants. And to that regard, there is a situation, there will be a scenario now where caps can be increased and will be monitored by the union. And that's important moving forward, because that's also alleviates that situation we've had for years where people, harvesters, are being told by plant workers what to do, when to go, what they can take, what they can't take. And that just, of course, leads to increased problems. So that's important. The other issue is also very significant, and that's a review of the licensing policy. You remember that's something I called for last year. You can't behave as badly as processors are in this province unless you have a provincial license. And finally, there's a recognition from the parties, well, certainly the province and the union, that that needs an investigation, and we need to be smarter, and we need to start doing business better. But this competition issue was at the heart of this matter, and it's finally dealt with.
And as you mentioned, for years, the FFAW has been raising concerns about corporate concentration in the fishery that is limiting competition at the wharf. How significant is it that changes are coming?
Well, here's the thing. For those, and it is a complex issue, there's no doubt about that, but I think the most simplistic approach to this for people on the outside is to understand a province where one company can bring crab into the province and process all they want, no problem, but the other business, harvesters, are stuck with cartel-like anti-competition companies that are doing exactly, it's not Canadian, it never was. But, you know, there was a time when we had competition on the wharves in this province. I remember that. It wasn't that long ago. But over the last 10, 12 years, behavior by these companies, that ever-shrinking number of companies, the ever-shrinking amount of processing done in this province, it's been dominated by those processors. So, you know, overall, Jerry Lynn, the industry has to be healthy to succeed. And it makes no difference if you're on the deck of a boat or you're on the floor, in the plant floor. There's no difference. Unless that industry is healthy and has competition, everybody's in trouble. And so that's why it's so significant, the significance of what happened last week, because I think we're on the road to a very good change for owner-operators and plant workers.
I'm speaking with FFAW President Greg Priddy. Now, there's been some concerns raised on social media that a panel or committee will have to assess all outside buyers. Is that the case?
Well, I don't think there's anything new there. I don't think that's the case at all. I mean, there's a regular licensing system in the province, and I expect that, and it's usually done by application, or not usually, always done by application. I guess that's still the situation. Anybody coming in here will have to play by provincial rules. They can't be renegades, and they have to show good conduct. So, you know, let's see what happens. I can't predict how this thing will unfold, but I don't think a panel will do it. The internal licensing division is quite capable of doing that, as I understand it.
And Greg, the Association of Seafood Producers is saying that some market restrictions are necessary to support plant workers. How do you see the plant workers' futures being impacted by the policy shifts?
Well, that's the thing, Jerry Lynn, as I just talked about. We can't have a system where we have plant workers, ever-shrinking numbers of plant workers in this province. We can't have a situation where harvesters are going bankrupt. We can't have a situation where harvesters are being licensed or being taken over by these corporations. We can't have illegal licensing. That's the path we were on last week. So there's a big change in that. And you can't look at this season to season. I mean, that's one of the reasons we're in the situation we're in today. We don't have a long-range view of what this fishery should look like. We should have more processing jobs in this province, not less. There's less every year, but there should be more. Why is one plant getting 4 weeks' work out of the biggest crab fishery in the world and another getting 16? What's all that about? So there has to be, there's a better way to do business. So our intention here is long range, and it's to ensure that we maximize the returns from not only the fishery, but from processing. And I used this example last week. You know, anybody who's ever been to Boston for the Boston Seafood Show, and you get on the floor and you look at the crab products on the floor, and you scratch your head and you say, Mike, dear God, what is going on here? Most of that's Canadian crab. A lot of that's Newfoundland crab. Why aren't we doing secondary processing on this stuff? Why aren't we enhancing the industry here as opposed to firing it in a truck and getting paid, the company's getting paid 30 days later, and that's a great model? Well, I call for a change in that, and I'm still calling for changes in that, because there's a better way to manage this fishery. There's marketing boards that can be brought in here. But most importantly, one of the things we're going to discover here very shortly is the need for loan boards for harvesters. We cannot continue depending on the cartel to fix the financial issues in the fishery, and in some cases lose your licenses over it. So that's important moving forward. So we will do that. We will review that. And at the end of the day, our hope, collectively, both harvesters and plant workers, is that we will have a healthier industry with stability. And that's been missing when you have this mix of the fish merchants and harvesters. You know, it's time to put some more balance in that, and it's time to have a better, more equitable fishery.
Greg Priddy, we are up against the clock, but just one more quick question. When do you expect word from government to officially release the details of this agreement?
I expect that will be this week and the next day or so. That wasn't an issue, although some groups are saying, yeah, that this the government has reneged. They have not. We spoke with the government as late as yesterday, and that is en route and will be delivered. No question about that. So I think overall we're on a good road here, and the only thing left now is to get the price in place and get this fishery up and going on time. And I hope I hope nothing changes on that issue today, but I'll keep you posted.
And that is Greg Priddy, president of the FFAW, speaking with VOCM's Jerry Lynn Mackey. Now, in other news, there was once a time when only sailors and inmates sported tattoos and often hid them from public view. But that sure has changed. Narrative Research recently asked Canadians if they have tattoos and how they feel about them. Margaret Chapman is chief operating officer and partner with Narrative Research. She joined us on Tuesday morning.
Were you surprised to find out that a third of Canadians have tattoos?
Well, we actually had a little in-office poll on this before we got the results back from our data collecting, and it was a really wide range, and a couple of people got close, but people guessed anywhere from 18% to 88%, so it just depends on who you see in your daily life, right, how many people you think have tattoos. But our results showed that a third of Canadians, actually 33.1% of the population across the country, have at least one tattoo.
And what types of questions did your survey ask?
Well, we wanted to know how many people had and how people feel about them, but also where on their body they were. Are they something that they can keep covered up if they want to, or are they something that's on display all the time? And I was a little bit surprised, I guess, to see that hardly anybody has regrets about their tattoos. Most people really like them if they have them.
And your results show some interesting relationships, yeah, between people who have tattoos and key demographics.
Yeah, so the boomer, the oldest age category, were the least likely to have tattoos. So I think only 17% of boomers said that they have a tattoo, where Gen X and Gen X and millennials are the most likely to have them. And then the youngest cohort actually are the least likely to have them. So it's kind of the middle age from 25 to 54 that have the highest likelihood of having a tattoo. In fact, about half of them do.
Wow, really? And were there any regional differences that came forward in the survey?
Not a whole lot. The only big difference that we saw was that people who live in the prairies, so Alberta and Saskatchewan, were a little bit more likely than people in other parts of the country to have tattoos. But otherwise, it was pretty much on the Canadian average of 33%. And the other kind of interesting thing about the numbers were that people kind of tend towards the, like, I just have one, or I have a whole bunch. So they were kind of bunched up in that way as well.
Yeah, were there any gender differences in the survey?
Yeah, this would surprise me too. Women were more likely than men to have tattoos. And so 38% of women on average across the country said they've got one or more, and 28% of men. So as you say, like in the olden days, you might have thought of just sailors having them, but now it's really become something that is body art, and women are very likely to have them. And they're proud of them too. Yeah.
Right. Not having those regrets about getting the tattoo in the first place. And what about people hiding them? Do many people tuck them away?
Well, this is kind of interesting. So they can. Most people say that if they were wearing long sleeve top and pants, most people say that they could not see their tattoos. So they must be mostly on arms and legs and parts that you can cover up if you wanted to. So 70% of people said, yeah, they can be hidden if I'm wearing long sleeve clothing. But then we also asked kind of more emotionally, how do you feel about your tattoos? And half of people with them said, I absolutely love them and I want to show them off every chance I can get. And then a quarter of people said, I love them, but they're kind of private and I keep them hidden most of the time.
And I'm speaking with Margaret Chapman, Chief Operating Officer and partner with Narrative Research. Margaret, why did you decide to do this research, and how might it be used?
Well, it was a bit of a fun one. We asked about a lot of serious topics, and, you know, with the financial circumstances that we're all living through with cost of living, a lot of our results are kind of heavy. And so we often try and think of a lighter topic that we can find out just to gauge what's going on in popular culture. So this was just a bit of a fun topic we wanted to ask about. I guess it's something that we can keep an eye on over the years to see if it's a trend that it's if it's waning, or if people are more likely to get tattoos. But it was more of a fun one we were curious about.
And it certainly doesn't sound like getting a tattoo in Canada is waning right now, does it?
A lot of people have them, for sure, yeah. And, you know, it's good to see, because they are permanent, that most people feel happy about their choices. Only 4% of people said, I'm so tired of my tattoos that I would have them removed if I could. So really, most people say that they're good with what they chose.
And that is Margaret Chapman, Chief Operating Officer and partner with Narrative Research. I can tell you, I have one tattoo and I certainly love it. Now heading over to government, still scrutinizing the provincial budget. Newfoundland and Labrador's 2024-25 budget continues to come under scrutiny for its increased spending and lack of measures to deal with debt. The province is forecasting a net debt of $17.8 billion for the fiscal year. That's a projected $32,807 per person by the end of the fiscal year, which makes Newfoundland and Labrador the most indebted province in Canada. The Fraser Institute has looked closely at the numbers and feels the provincial government missed the opportunity to return to a balanced budget and begin paying off debt. Alex Whalen is Associate Director of Atlantic Canada Prosperity with the Fraser Institute. He joined us on Monday morning. The Liberal government promised, quote, prudent fiscal management. Does this budget go far enough in bringing spending under control and reducing our debt load?
Absolutely not. It does neither. It doesn't bring spending under control and it doesn't reduce the debt load. The province has succeeded in bringing down the operating deficit over the past few years, although that's largely due to buoyant oil and gas revenues. When you look closer at the numbers, they're hiking spending. They're running a deficit. They had promised they would balance the budget this year. They did not do that. And overall, Newfoundland and Labrador's massive debt problem continues to get worse.
How concerning is it that we do have the highest spending and highest net debt of more than $32,000 per person in the entire country?
It's very concerning for a couple of reasons. The first reason I would mention is just how much more debt Newfoundland and Labrador has than the other provinces. So as you mentioned off the top, provincial debt this year will rise to $32,807 per person. That is many thousands of dollars per person higher than the next province. And it's before you even account for the fact that Newfoundlanders and Labradorians are responsible for a share of the federal debt, which is also rising. So quite a bit of concern on the level of debt that's being racked up. And another concern I would mention when it comes to debt is that the province's debt load has been rising at a time when the oil and gas industry is strong. And what that means is that the province has been taking in quite a high level of new revenues, which are simply being funneled into growing the size of government. And we know from the past that when inevitably those revenues fluctuate, the province will plunge back into deeper deficits. So it's not just a concern now, it's very much a concern going forward.
I was going to ask you next about in what ways are the Liberal government repeating the mistakes of the past, but I guess that would probably be number one.
Absolutely. I mean, the management of resource revenues is certainly high on that list. I think not taking the opportunity to run the balanced budget, run a surplus and start paying down debt, simply expanding the size of government has been tried before, and that's why the province is where it is.
We're speaking with Alex Whalen, Associate Director, Atlantic Canada Prosperity at the Fraser Institute. And Alex, is there a bit of good news there in the Future Fund?
A little bit. We praised the Future Fund concept when the Fury government introduced it a couple of years ago. They are making a contribution to the Future Fund. For people who may not know, the Future Fund is a fund that the province set up to save some of its oil and gas revenues. But that good news is unfortunately really quite muted when you look at the overall picture, because they're contributing $72 million to the Future Fund at a time when they're going to add about $600 million to the provincial debt. So the Future Fund is a great concept, and we'd like to see it strengthened and improved going forward, but it's really being conflicted by the province's overall fiscal approach.
So, Alex, Canada's parliamentary budget officer has said the Newfoundland and Labrador's debt situation is unsustainable. What exactly does that mean, and what will happen if spending isn't curtailed and debt brought under control?
It means that provincial debt as a share of the economy is rising over time. That's the definition that they use for unsustainability. We concur with that assessment. The bottom line is it means that the province needs to balance the budget and start to bring debt down over time. That's something they promised to do in the past and that they did not do in this budget, unfortunately. But I think the Parliamentary Budget Officer's analysis and our analysis is quite clear that that will have to be done at some point.
And that is Alex Whalen, Associate Director, Atlantic Canada Prosperity with the Fraser Institute. Now, from the provincial government to the federal government, they're highlighting funding set aside for the International Youth Internship Program and particularly how it will affect students at the Marine Institute. The Institute is receiving over $4 million to fund 190 internships internationally that focus on environmental sustainability, adaptation to climate change, and improving gender equality. VOCM's Richard Duggan and others were at the Marine Institute to hear from Minister Ahmad Hussein and the school's Vice President, Paul Brett.
I recently announced the launch of a new iteration of the International Youth Internship Program. The program offers Canadians aged 18 to 30 the opportunity to gain professional experience abroad in various sectors of international development. This includes areas such as gender equality, education, human rights, global health, agriculture, law, and more. 7,000 young people have benefited from this program so far over the last 25 years. The focus of the new International Youth Internship Program will be those who are traditionally not involved in these types of internship programs, those who traditionally don't get these opportunities, and they face barriers. This includes those who face barriers to employment, youth living with disabilities, as well as indigenous, racialized, and 2SLGBTQI plus youth. With $24.5 million in new funding, six organizations were selected. Each organization will select more than 800 eligible youth to complete internships in more than 40 countries around the world. And of course, one of these organizations is a long-standing partner of this internship program and one that has implemented more than 250 projects in 50 countries. The Fisheries and Marine Institute of Memorial University, in partnership with the Atlantic Council for International Cooperation. And they're already accepting applications to this program.
Can you just elaborate maybe on some of the work that students could potentially be doing through this program and maybe some of the doors that it could open up for them?
So I can talk a little bit from experience, not that I was an IET participant, but some of my students who traveled internationally to use the skills they gained from programs here at the Institute to practice them on an international stage. So they get to learn a lot about what it's like not here. What does culture, differences in culture, what competencies would they gain from that international experience. So it's really taking their skills from their home institution and using them outside of Canada. So there's huge opportunity in doing that. They bring something new back to Canada.
Good Sunday morning, happy Easter, and welcome to the best of your VOCM mornings. I'm Ben Murphy, and now we're going to go to Tech Talk Tuesday, where we dove into the issues around cyber attacks crippling Canadian hospitals, businesses, and vital services, then everything you need to know about the upcoming solar eclipse on April 8th, and finally, the U.S. Justice Department slams Apple with a major antitrust lawsuit. Joining us to break it all down is our local tech expert, Kevin Andrews.
Cyber attacks are crippling hospitals, businesses, and vital services right across Canada. Experts point to readily available hacking tools and the explosion of the ransomware industry as key reasons. So, Kevin, with these cyber attacks escalating, what's driving this dangerous trend and how can we fight back?
Well, I mean, no question that cyber attacks are on the rise, and I think really for a few reasons. I mean, technology that helps create malware is now more accessible, including AI-powered programs, really making it easier for less skilled individuals to launch really sophisticated attacks that are, I think, harder to really detect now. And so, you know, the ransomware industry is also booming, becoming really, I think, a multi-billion dollar criminal enterprise. And it's also supported by countries, so making cyber attacks safer for them and even more profitable. So, you know, we've seen firsthand the effects of these attacks, particularly in their universities and healthcare systems in recent years. So I think, you know, to stay safe, people really should need to regularly update their device software. Think about using a technology that they call passkeys. But if not, you know, use strong, unique passwords. I know it's a pain. It's a pain point for many. And so I'd recommend, you know, using a password manager. If not, then like 1Password, or there's another one called Dashlane. And so also too, you know, be careful when opening emails from, especially from messages from known and really unknown sources. I also recommend too, you using antiviruses or ransomware or malware protection software on personal devices is also, you know, really another good idea. So I think the bottom line here is really with the cyber attacks becoming more advanced and lucrative, it's essential for really everybody to stay alert, update your defenses, and really invest in security to stay safe.
So, Kevin, in other news, on April 8th, a total solar eclipse will mesmerize viewers globally. So can you just tell us more about this eclipse and where exactly it'll be visible?
Yeah, I mean, this is a fascinating event where the moon aligns perfectly between the sun and the earth and a cast of shadow. And this shadow will sweep across the earth along a specific path that they call the path of totality. And so this path starts in the remote South Pacific Ocean and moves across the earth, reaching Mexico's west coast before heading towards the U.S., Canada, and even here in Newfoundland and Labrador. And so the biggest question I've been getting lately is, what's the best place here in Newfoundland and Labrador to watch this solar eclipse? And really, based on my research, the southwest coast, including the Cotteroy Valley, is a good place. Other notable locations would be like Gander, Terranova National Park, the Baccalieu Coastal Drive, and even the Bonavista Peninsula. Now, Fogo Island is also another great place, and really here in St. John's, you'll also be able to see it as well. Now, the length of the total eclipse will vary depending on where you are within that path of totality. And so if you're interested in getting the best view for the longest time, just head over to the website eclipse2024.org, and you can find more information there. One more point to consider, too. If you enjoy cloudy skies, well, you're in luck. Since 2000, the weather on this day has been cloudy 78% of the time. So odds are we might have a front row seat to some clouds. I'm hoping for clear skies, though.
Yeah, you and I both. But maybe that means we're due for clear skies, you know, after all these years of cloudy skies whenever we have a chance at one of these.
I think so.
So let's say we do have a chance to see this, and we can see it quite well, and the skies are clear. Capturing a solar eclipse is definitely thrilling, but it does require careful preparation because using the wrong equipment can damage cameras and even harm eyesight. Space agencies and experts emphasize the need for precautions to safely photograph this rare event. So, Kevin, can you just elaborate on that and these precautions and why they're so crucial?
Yeah, I mean, when, you know, taking pictures of this solar eclipse is crucial, like you mentioned, to protect your camera, protect your eyes. I mean, directly pointing your camera at the sun during the eclipse can really expose it to excessive light and heat, potentially damaging it. So, you know, photographs and people who want to take a lot of pictures recommend using proper equipment and precautions to avoid this risk. And so one important precaution is to use what they call a solar filter to protect your phone's camera during the partial phase of the eclipse, as you would use eclipse glasses to protect your eyes. And so this filter helps reduce the intense light and heat from the sun, which would then prevent damage to your phone's camera. Now, during the totality, when the moon completely blocks the sun, you'll need to remove the filter to really capture the sun's outer atmosphere, which they call the corona. Now, even if a sliver of the sun reappears, it's really important then to reapply that filter to protect your eyes and your camera again. So, you know, people taking pictures also suggest using a tripod to prevent blurry pictures, and they recommend covering your phone's lens sometimes with your eclipse glasses for really added protection. So, again, if the weather cooperates, I'll be out there with my camera, solar filter, and eclipse glasses all set to seize the day, and if not, there's always August 23rd, 2044.
Well, we hope this one works out so we don't have to wait that long to potentially see this again. But Kevin, just finally on another topic, the U.S. Justice Department has filed an antitrust lawsuit against Apple, claiming the company established an illegal smartphone monopoly. Can you just kind of delve into the specifics of these allegations?
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. Department has launched a major antitrust, like you mentioned, lawsuit against Apple. And they're alleging that Apple, which is one of the tech giants, have built really an illegal smartphone monopoly. And the suit claims that Apple leverages its control of the iPhone to stifle competition and innovate less and impose unnecessary fees on consumers and developers. Now, Apple strongly denies these allegations, calling the lawsuit not factual and legally flawed. And they believe it sets a harmful precedent for government interference in the design of technology. And Apple defends its walled garden approach as really they say it's vital for user privacy and security and really a superior experience. So I think let's sort of see how this plays out in the legal arena and how it might impact the tech industry as a whole.
And that is our local techspert, Kevin Andrews. Now, in other news, one of the province's biggest fundraisers is back for its 40th year this June. For this year's 40th anniversary Janeway Telethon event, fundraising efforts will support a large range of equipment, education, and research projects at the Janeway Children's Hospital and Rehabilitation Center. There will be a particular priority on caring for our sickest, most vulnerable children and high-risk developing babies. Rebecca Dutton is president and CEO of the Janeway Children's Hospital Foundation. She joined us in the VOCM studios on Tuesday morning.
How exciting is it to have the 40th Janeway Telethon coming this June?
I know. It's a huge milestone. It's we've been really excited about it, and we're making the rounds and trying to get the community excited about it, too.
Well, just you and I chatting here before we came to air, there's a lot of memories there.
There absolutely are. I don't remember the first telethon, but I remember early telethons, and I have a check on my at my office that my sister found in my mom's old files that was from the first telethon, $10 check that she wrote, and for some reason it was in some of her old banking files, and it has, you know, down in the memo for Becky and Robin, and she framed it for me because my mom has passed away, and she loves seeing her handwriting and her name and all that, and she framed it for me, and it reminds me every single day when I look at it that every $10 counts, and it's so nice to have something from the first telethon in my office that I look at every day.
I just showed you my arm. I have goosebumps just racking my body hearing you say that, Rebecca. Is there anything special happening to commemorate the 40th anniversary?
We are bringing back old hosts. We are bringing back old video, old miracle stories. We are retelling a lot of kind of the historical stuff from past telethons, but to show the impact over the years, there's so many adults, parents, grandmas, grandpas out there that owe their health and their lives and their families to the care that they received at the Janeway over the years. I had, you know, stitches. I'd been back and forth to the Janeway so many times as a child myself. Now, I was there yesterday as a mom taking my child to the Janeway for his regular appointments for a chronic pain condition that he has. So there's so many of us that have lots of Janeway stories to tell over the years and have, you know, grown up as well. And we want to retell those stories and see where people are now. We have the champion stories and the miracle stories from over the years, and we're looking out to the community to collect those. We've got lots in our archives, but we want to hear from people through our website, janewayfoundation.nf.ca. People can go on, share their story, and upload old videos that they have. We don't have a lot from the 80s and 90s, and we know that there's lots of nans and pops that have their have the old VHS video, and if you have VHS and you can't upload it, you connect with us, and we will happily get that borrow that from you and digitize some of it and play it on the telethon and on social media leading up to the telethon.
I can remember volunteering with the telethon as a young girl. I was telling you before we spoke on the air about it, right? Going with my mom to answer the calls, so I'll have to see if she has any of those
photos hanging
around.
And anything like that. There's so many people out there that have volunteered and will certainly have photos and old photo albums. Take a picture of those and post it on social media and tag us and, you know, get the community thinking back about, their involvement in the telethon over the years and what that means to them. And, we were kind of talking before about so many of, you know, our parents over the years and grandparents and even us participated in Jean's Day for the Janeway. And a lot of that has gone by the wayside over the last few years because people are working from home. And there's lots of ways that you can kind of reinvigorate that in your office environments or with your groups, community groups. You can have, you know, those throwback Jean's Day for the Janeway. They raised a lot of money over the years, and it would be incredible if we could reengage the community in that, because that money is really, really important. It buys a lot of really vital equipment, and it makes our children's hospital what it is. The technology changes constantly. It gets way more. It's getting far more expensive over the years, and we need to make sure that our children have what they need. You know, like I said, a lot of us in the community have been touched with the Janeway and owe our health to the care that's provided there.
I was going to ask why it's important, but I think you've just nailed that, Rebecca. I'm speaking with Rebecca Dutton. She is the president and CEO of the Janeway Children's Hospital Foundation. So what is the goal for this year for money raised?
We're holding on to that a little bit. So hopefully we'll announce that getting closer to the event when we have a bit of a sense of how much we think we might be able to raise. We're going to try to set it a little bit higher this year.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. A teaser there. And who is this year's champion child?
John Bennett from Mount Pearl. We just announced our champion child last year. So John Bennett has cystic fibrosis, and he is just an inspiration. He is a really active teenager. He has completely taken control of his illness, and he does not let it control him. He is at absolute superstar athlete. He, you know, does his own therapies. He does, his family is incredibly involved in his care. And he is one of those kids that shows the amazing care that he's received over the years. He's back and forth to Janeway every 3 months, and the care team is like family to him.
An absolute inspiration. How big an effort is the telethon each year, Rebecca? And every year from, you know, the folks at the Janeway to the countless volunteers involved.
Oh my gosh, it takes an entire army. It is unbelievable. So many volunteers throughout the year, so many fundraisers, so many things that come together to, you know, make Telethon weekend possible. It really is a whole year fundraising effort, and we just can't thank the community enough for being involved.
Awesome. Just quickly, how can people get involved? How can people help?
Head to janewayfoundation.nf.ca. They can make a gift today, of course. We'll happily do that. But there's lots of ways to get involved. You can click on various tabs on our website, and depending on how you want to be involved. And like I said, you can make a donation starting anytime.
And that is Rebecca Dutton, President and CEO of the Janeway Children's Hospital Foundation, the 40th anniversary Janeway Telethon event coming up in June. Now, the provincial budget set aside $4.3 million for wraparound supports for young people and young families. Choices for Youth is pleased with the additional funds. Jen Crow is Senior Director of Strategy, Fund Development, and External Relations with Choices for Youth. She joined us in the VOCM studios Wednesday morning.
Just how badly needed is this funding?
Yeah, absolutely, Ben. So for those of you who don't know, Choices for Youth is a nonprofit organization focused on ending youth homelessness in Newfoundland and Labrador. And so we do that through a blend of wraparound supports, including housing availability across a continuum of housing, food security, basic needs. We own and operate several social enterprises. And one of the things that we've been noticing, Ben, over the last several years is an increase in the number of young people who are coming to us, who are traveling from outside of the metro region to access our supports. So we support about 1,300 young people every year. Right now, 26% of those youth have recently traveled to St. John's to access services. And when you talk to them, Ben, you know, one of the things that they tell us often is they didn't come to St. John's because they wanted to come to St. John's. They came to St. John's because they felt they had to come to St. John's, because in order to get their needs met, access services, access housing, that was the only choice they had available to us. So that's really where we started several years ago, really trying to understand what are the issues facing youth outside of the St. John's metro region, and what is our role in trying to address their needs outside of the Avalon region.
So what additional programming will now be provided at Choices for Youth?
Yeah, so with this investment of $4.3 million from the provincial government, we will be working with Newfoundland and Labrador Health Services and 65 partners across the province to think about what kind of model look like outside of St. John's Metro. So specifically what that will look like is we'll be will be admitting a request for proposals for two additional sites in two rural regions of our province. And we imagine that that will look like a blend of having on-site housing supports, basic needs food security, family supports, therapy, primary care, and mental health supports, all through a one-stop shop. And Ben, that's really critical because we understand from a lot of the youth who we support, they're often told, oh, you got to go down the road to get your appointment. You have to go this way for a food bank. You know, you have to go the other way for housing supports. Our goal is to make it simple, to make it easy so that we can help make sure that young people get their needs met as quickly as possible. And that's exactly what we hope these sites will achieve. We have a proven model in St. John's. We've been operating for over 30 years at Carter's Hill Place. And so that site will be operating as a network with the two additional sites outside of the St. John's metro region.
Yeah, so how exactly does this model that's here in the metro region, how does it work and how will that expand?
Absolutely. So to give you an example, you know, a young person can come to us 5 days a week at our Carter's Hill Place location. They can walk through our doors. They can get a hot meal. While they're waiting for their, while they're eating their hot meal, sorry, they can wait and see a physician on site so they can be seen immediately. While they're, you know, visiting with that physician can have discussions with them around what are they experiencing. Oh, maybe they'll realize that conversation that that young person is experiencing homelessness. They can bring in a housing support worker to have a conversation with that young person about getting their housing needs met along with their primary care needs. That young person can go downstairs. They can meet with a family therapist. They can have conversations about getting connected with our education, employment, and social enterprise teams. They can get trained and employed in four social enterprises. So really what we hope is that no matter what a young person is experiencing in their life, no matter what barriers, there's something for them in this integrated youth services site. And we've really been able to see the outcomes of this model in practice. So just to give you one example, in one of our programs, our Mama Moments program, which is supporting young moms and their children, we're actually able to decrease emergency room visits by 88% through that model. We're also able to increase housing stability by 60% through 18 months of engagement in that model. So again, we really see that by, you know, looking at all the needs of a young person and having a holistic approach, you can really make a tremendous difference in the lives of these youth. And we also want to make sure that young people are centered in this model as well. We have two youth advisory councils, and those youth advisory councils are really steering what does this model need to look like outside of the St. John's metro region, and what's going to benefit them the most.
Yeah, and what does this model look like outside the metro region?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we've been working with eight steering committees for the past 5 years or so. And those steering committees have really helped develop a model that is tailor-made for their region. So while we know that they will all include a combination of mental health supports, therapy, primary care, housing supports, family supports, and basic needs, exactly what that looks like, that's really tailored to each of the regions that we'll be looking at. So we don't know exactly right now, but we have heard from several organizations and communities across the region, for example, that some of them would like to see like land-based services, for example, especially if they're serving a high degree of Indigenous young people. Others are supporting more newcomers, so tailor-made services to support them. We recognize that for us at Choices for Youth, we support about 26% of the young people coming to us are 2S LGBTQIA+. So services that are tailor-made for those populations. So it will look a little bit different region to region, but there will be a general model. The integrated youth services model is the best practice internationally, and we want to make sure that we're in adherence to that proven model across the province. So it's a blend of that kind of transformative model that we know that works, tailor-made to the unique needs of each of the regions.
Good Sunday morning and welcome back to the best of your VOCM mornings, hoping you're having a wonderful start to your Easter Sunday. The Vera Perlin Society in St. John's has been serving people with developmental disabilities since 1954. This year marks their 70th anniversary and there are some big things planned. Marianne Oakley is CFO and Sandy King is fundraising coordinator with the Vera Perlin Society. They both joined us here in the VOCM studios Wednesday morning.
For those who may not know, what is the Vera Perlin Society? I'll start with you, Marianne.
Yeah, sure. So the Vera Perlin Society, we began in 1954, and it was started by Vera Crosby Perlin with a purpose to educate individuals with an intellectual disability at that time. So over the years, we've evolved into many programs and services, still with the mandate of providing those programs and services to adults and teenage kids with an intellectual disability.
And 70 years celebrating.
It's amazing.
Yeah. It really amazing. Is. So what are you doing to celebrate, Sandy?
Well, I don't know if I'm more nervous or excited about announcing this fundraiser. It just launched a few weeks ago there, Jerry. So it's called the Spring Days Lottery Prize. It has over $40,000 worth of gift cards and merchandise. I'd love to give out a big shout out to all of our sponsors. I don't know if I got a quick second there, Jerry, to announce them. We got, Island Furniture, Lanty Trailer and Tractor, Terra Nova Cottages in the RV Park. We have Eastern Siding, Marie's Mini Mart. We have the Milwaukee Tools. We got Mark's Work Warehouse. We got Molson Coors. We got Smith's Home Hardware. We got Canadian Tire, RDM Industrial. We got Peter's Pizza, The Woodshed, and Bursey's Manufacturing in CBS.
Fantastic
we
turnout.
We have great community support.
Oh, we certainly do. We can't do this without them. And to our listeners out there, we would really appreciate your support if you can come on and purchase a ticket. You can visit us at www.veraplinsociety.ca. And if you have any questions, give us a call at 709-739-6017.
There you go. Getting it all out there, Sandy. Marianne, why is it important to mark such an anniversary?
Well, 70 years is a significant time in the community, and a local charitable organization to be successful for 70 years, delivering the valued services that we do, it's important for everybody to recognize this organization and support us because the work we do is invaluable.
Absolutely. Sandy, I'm bringing it back to you. Now, tell me more about some of the prizes. What are the prizes
people
can win?
Island Furniture has been in partnership with us for many, many years, employing individuals with intellectual disabilities. So a big shout out to them. They have come on board with a $30,000 gift card. I mean, that's amazing.
Huge.
Amazing.
$30,000.
I mean, that's going to buy you some really nice furniture for, you know, and appliances they do sell too. You know, bedroom sets, living room sets. People are opening up their cabins. They want a new couch. I mean, it's just amazing. New snowblower. Hey, we're not done with snow yet, okay? We need a new snowblower. Hopefully we are, but you know what? We always get that major snowstorm happening in April, so that will help. We got some beer. We got some pizza. Eastern Siding. I mean, with that wind blowing all winter, we're going to need to probably fix some siding, some doors, some windows. So go up and see our girl Deanne up there. We got Marie's Mini Mart. Big shout out to Daryl. Over $1,000. And gift cards.
Wow.
From Marie's Mini Mart. I mean, you want your bag of chips, you go to Marie's, right? We have Smith's Home Hardware, beautiful bistro set that's going to be out on your patio if you're a lucky winner. Have some coffee, what have you. Listen to you guys early in the morning. We have a barbecue. We have some things from the Woodshed. The Woodshed has come on board with some beautiful products to get that steak going. Bursey's Manufacturing, you got to go online. I mean, their signs and their fire pits that they make, can't tell you enough things about them. Amazing work up there. Thank you, Sherry.
Fantastic to hear it. Marianne, how can people get involved? How can they get tickets?
Okay, we're trying to make it easy. This is our first time doing an online fundraiser. Yes. So we're cautiously optimistic that it will be quite successful. We have our website is linked to where you can purchase some tickets. So you go on www.veraperlinsociety.ca and there is a purchase tickets there. And when you click there, you're taken to our charitable website where you put in your information and we'll process the tickets. And as our organization has been successful, it's a lot of the self-help. We've always used a self-help mandate. And when we try, this is our first time doing anything this big, so we're doing it very much from scratch. We're doing it ourselves. We're eliminating anything that could possibly impede us in having a successful fundraiser. So we're physically processing the tickets ourselves, and we will get those tickets out to you within 5 to 7 days. So it's $20 a ticket. There's only 10,000 tickets printed, so it's a good chance to win. And you know, it's hopefully going to be one of our best successful fundraisers ever.
I love that you're keeping it in-house, and it's a grassroots push here.
Yeah.
Well, when's the draw date, Sandy?
It is on May the 17th, just in time for the May 2-4 weekend. So get your tickets.
But the last day to process or to buy tickets is May 5th because we need time to process those tickets. Yes. So Sunday, May 5th is the last chance that you can purchase a ticket. Now, we're hoping we're going to be sold out by then. You know, fingers crossed, but you have till May 5th.
And that is Marianne Oakley, CFO, and Sandy King, fundraising coordinator with the Vera Perlin Society. Well, we still do have a little more to get through Today, it might be Easter Sunday, but it's also known as the International Trans Day of Visibility. It's a day to celebrate transgender people and let others know about the unfair treatment they often face around the world. This year, Art4SNL, a charity that helps at-risk young people through art, is working with Quadrangle to put on an event that will showcase the work of transgender artists. Gemma Hickey, who runs Art4SNL, joined us Thursday morning to share the details.
What are your thoughts on this International Day set aside to raise awareness and celebrate the lives and contributions of trans people?
Well, you know, it's not just one day for me or for trans people, you know, especially that how we present in our own lives. Like, every day is that day, kind of day for us. And every day, as we're out, we raise more awareness about what's happening. But it shouldn't be on us. And that's why we need our allies to step up now more than ever. So building up to that day, there's all kinds of events happening around the world. And locally here, I felt that it was important for our organization to partner up with Quadrangle to host a chosen family dinner. And what that means, basically, is that queer and trans people sometimes can't depend on their families for support. So we pick our families through our community. And so we'll be offering some food, a free meal as well, and of course the event is to, you have to pre-register based on the escalation of hate and everything. We're not disclosing the location. However, we will be featuring a number of trans artists that were published in one of our projects, which is 8 years old today, called Transversing. And that play was directed by the unstoppable Bernie Stapledon and produced, and as well as Art4SNL. And then we also published it with Breakwater Books. So incredible community partnerships happening, and so happy to feature young artists tonight at this event, given what's happening in the country and, you know, due to the day that's coming up.
And Gemma, you mentioned that escalation of hate and social media, a very nasty place a lot of the time. Has society become more accepting of trans people? Are we making progress or are we taking steps backwards right now?
I feel like we're making steps forward, but we're also making some steps backward. Great. Obviously, we look at the political climate across Canada now. And, you know, we had a CSIS warning recently against violence or directed towards trans people. We see what's happening in New Brunswick and Saskatchewan with pronoun policies and misinformation around parental rights and medication, important medication interventions that are being interfered by the Premier of Alberta, basically, through these new policies. So people are scared in my community. Even though we have more rights now, the fear is still there. And that's why it's important to have our allies step up and to host events where trans people can feel safe to be able to express themselves to people, where they can just be themselves. And living our truths means that we expose ourselves to threats, harassment, discrimination oftentimes. And that's a political act within itself. Survival is a political act given the times we're living in. And I feel very much about, you know, when I have love, when I experience joy, happiness, I feel like that's how we win this fight, by being and trying to carve out some space for ourselves and experience joy and be around people that we know we can be nurtured by.
And there you have it. That is Gemma Hickey. Well, our time is up here on the best of your VOCM mornings. Hope you have a wonderful rest of your Easter Sunday and a happy International Trans Day of Visibility as well. I'm Ben Murphy. We'll be back tomorrow morning on your VOCM mornings, 5:30 to 9 a.m. Have a safe and happy Easter Sunday. I'm easy like Sunday morning.